up with. They're a little bit better than the ones I talked about last time. So I'm going to work towards explaining the, in quotes, best models that we got where you gauge BNL, baryon number and lepton number. And I'll talk a tiny bit about just gauging baryon number. The most important part of this is actually not the specific model, which, you know, it's just a few equations you solve. You write down a Lagrangian, it has some features. But it's the motivation. Why would you want to do this? Is this a reasonable thing to look at? So I'm going to spend some time building up to the model, and I'll talk very briefly about the model that I presented last time and then this other model that I think is a little bit better. Yeah, I think this is the end of my part of my career where I gauge BNL. There's only so much you can do. You're seeing the culmination here of gauging BNL. Okay, let me, I have to put on this chart. I'm not going to, oh, geez Louise. Yeah, it's okay if they go up. It's good, it's good. So let me put it here. I have this table I always put, which is the standard model. And because if you write down this table and you're a theorist, then it tells you everything we know, or most of what we know. And we're going to build on it, of course. So they've got your fields in the standard model. You've got the gauge quantum numbers. And that's where it ends for the standard model. And of course, we're going to talk about a U1 for baryon number and a U1 for lepton number. And then there's just what are the particles. And the great thing about the standard model, how we think about it now, is once I tell you the gauge group and the fields, you just write down the most general Lagrangian, and then you use experiment to fix the couplings, and you go home after that. That's the whole story. Of course, we're not talking about gravity here. Gravity's just classical for this talk. You have to get a little more highfalutin theorist to talk about gravity than I am. So you got the quark doublets, left-handed doublets. They're a triplet under color, a doublet under SU2. They got hypercharge of 6, baryon number a third, and no lepton number. Then you got the right-handed up quarks, the right-handed down quarks. And these are also color triplets. And they're singlets under the SU2, and their hypercharge is the same as their charge, so it's 2, 3, minus a third, and of course they all have baryon number a third. And then we have the left-handed lepton doublet, which contains left-handed neutrino and left-handed charge leptons. They have no color. They're a doublet under SU2. They have hypercharge a half, I think, minus a half, because I have put the zero charge there. And they have no baryon number and lepton number 1. And then you have the right-handed fields, electron fields, and they have no color. They're singlets, hypercharge minus 1, lepton number 1. And that's all the particles we have experimental evidence for. Of course, you can't make up a sensible theory with just these that fits the data. You have to have the Higgs doublet. Well, maybe you could have something else, but it's got no color. It's a doublet under SU2. It's got hypercharge a half and no baryon number, no lepton number. And I should put a little break here because we don't have any evidence for it yet, except you can't get a consistent theory without something that breaks the weak symmetry, and this is the simplest thing. Of course, there's data that suggests it's a doublet under SU2. And then sometimes people add right-handed neutrinos. And the right-handed neutrinos, they're just singlets under everything, and they have lepton number 1. So that's the standard model in a nutshell. That says what we know about it. And then we go ahead and we compare with experiment. We write down the Lagrangian. We compare with experiment and fit all the couplings. And it works awesomely grand. Awesomely great. It's an amazing thing. So amongst the things that that we see when we compare with data is that we observe that baryon number is not violated. Just look at things like the lifetime of the proton. There's a very good limit. Something like the lifetime of the proton is greater than about 10 to the 32 years. This, of course, depends somewhat on the modes you look at, but you know, most modes give a lifetime around that level. You actually get a pretty good limit on the lifetime, well, nowhere near this, just from the fact that I don't, my hair doesn't fall out after the talk. That ends up being 10 to the 10 years. I calculated that at my mother's over the weekend. But of course, you can do much better if you have a giant vat of water and you stare at it for a long time. Of course, you have to have a pretty depressed economy before you find it satisfying to stare at a giant vat of water for a long time. And that's why this is done in Japan. Part of the future of Fermilab is such an experiment. That's my one joke. You can also look at neutrinoless double beta decay if you want to talk about lepton number violation. And there you get lifetimes of around 10 to the 25 years. These are the things you might look at if you're interested in baryon number violation and lepton number violation. Of course, we observe neutrino masses. Actually, we observe the differences of masses squared. We haven't observed any masses directly. And so there's one which is called the solar mass difference, which is about 8 times 10 to the minus 5 electron volts squared. And there's another one, and that's about 3 times 10 to the minus 3 eV squared. Usually we think that these are signals of lepton number violation, but they don't have to be. You don't know that experimentally. Depends on how you put lepton masses in. So that's the facts, that baryon-baryon number and lepton number. We know something about mixing angles as well, but you know, I haven't got that much time, so let me not dwell on that. So now I want to put this in the context of the standard model. This is the standard model fields. How do we understand these few facts? Is it nice? Is it attractive? Is it something we have to do something disgusting? Often you have to do something disgusting, and that motivates a lot of other theoretical work, which usually ends up being equally disgusting, but you try. Okay, so first I'm going to talk about baryon number in the standard model. And then I'm going to talk about lepton number. And this is by way of providing motivation for what I'm going to do later. I like gravity. I like being stuck to the floor. It's all good. It's all good. Okay, so baryon number is a global symmetry. You take each of the quarks, it doesn't matter left or right, it's a vector-like symmetry, and you multiply them by a phase, charge 3. It's a global symmetry. And classically, the Lagrangian's invariant, so it's a symmetry. But it's not a symmetry at the quantum level, it's anomalous. So let me remind you of that. So you look at triangle diagrams to see if it has an anomaly. And so you put baryon number here. And you could have SU2 bosons here, let's say. Or you could have, for example, baryon number here. And then you could have U1 hypercharge bosons here. Or you could have 3 baryon number vertices, et cetera, when you talk about anomalies. So let's calculate some of the anomalies just to get a feeling for what's going on. I guess it was Tuff to first realize it was anomalous, and he actually calculated the proton lifetime from non-perturbative effects associated with this. It was really long. Okay, what do? I got a B there, so that's a third. I got 3. Oh, I forgot to say something. There's 3 generations of quarks and leptons. We don't understand why. Maybe there's 4, but they're heavier. Well, there's some ugly things when that happens that I'll mention shortly. Okay, so back to this. So if this is a third, this is the baryon number. Then there's 3 generations. Then there's 3 colors. Then the only thing that can go in the loop here is the quark doublet. It has to have SU2 charge and baryon number. So there's a trace TA, TB, which is delta AB over 2 from the loop. So I put a half here, and so you get 3 halves. So it's definitely anomalous. Another anomaly could be B, let's say U1 squared, the hypercharge. Let's check that one. So again, it's a third from baryon number. There's 3 generations. There's 3 colors. And now I have to get the hypercharge squared. And both the left-handed and right-handed quarks contribute. So a 6 squared is a 36, 1 over 36. Thought you'd be impressed. But then you get a factor of 2 from the doublet. And the right-handed fields contribute opposite the left, so you put a minus sign in for those. So 2/3 becomes minus 4/9, minus 1/9, and this ends up being minus 3/2. Let's check a few more just so we get a sense what's going on. If I have baryon number cubed, I know that's going to be 0. Because baryon number, if I leave out all the other quantum numbers, it's vector-like. You have a right-handed thing matching up with each left-handed one. And so there won't be any anomalies just involving B alone. It's vector-like. So that vanishes. And let's just check one more so I don't completely bore you. Let's say B squared U1Y. So that gives me a 9th from the baryon number squared, 3 generations, 3 colors. Now I'm just linear in this, so I get the 6, and the doublet has 2 fields in it. And then I get minus 2/3, the minus for the right-handed, and plus 1/3, and so this is 0. And so all the anomalies, the things that are preventing it from a quantum symmetry, are linear in B. That's the lesson from this. Now, one of the great things about the standard model is that, in some sense, we understand why the proton decay lifetime is so long, why baryon number conservation is so accurate, if we make one assumption. So what is that assumption going to be? Excuse me. Lunch. So how do we understand? Well, we just try to write down an operator that violates baryon number in the standard model. And it ends up, just because of the particle content, gauge symmetries, there's no renormalizable operator you can write down. There's no dimension 5 operator you can write down. The first time you get it is dimension 6. So here's an example of such an operator. I'm going to view the standard model as an effective field theory. We know it's an effective field theory, so we should add to it non-renormalizable operators suppressed by some scale. And so we will. So let's put 1 over lambda squared because dimension 6. And then you could have, let's say, U right, D right, E right. I forget how many operators there are altogether. I think Weinberg first worked out the list of linearly independent dimension 6 operators when I was a graduate student. OK, so there's an operator like this and some others. It's invariant under all the gauge symmetries. For example, you put alpha, beta, gamma for the color indices and contract them with an epsilon, and you can contract all the Lorentz indices because it's got 4 fields, so it's invariant under all the gauge symmetries. It's got no total charge, and so the hypercharges have to work out. So now you take that proton lifetime, and because you get 1 over lambda squared here, you get 1 over lambda 4 to the width, and so lambda to the 4th in the lifetime, and it has to, by dimensional analysis, the rest is like QCD, properties of the proton, so you'll get something like this. And so if you want to get a lifetime of order 10 to the 33 years, you need a lambda 10 to the 32 years, you need a lambda greater than about 10 to the 15th GeV. So indeed, we've understood the conservation of baryon number in the standard model, provided to the accuracy that we need it, provided the cutoff is this big. Well, I called it a cutoff. What do I mean by that? It's not really a cutoff. I'm not using some momentum cutoff. It's a scale at which new physics comes in that generates this operator. And if you have a theory that has no new physics up to this scale, sometimes we talk about it as having a desert. How many people in this room are excited about the LHC? Just waiting to see what it's going to find, right? Should have seen all the hands. Two hands, come on. You know what that means? It means you don't believe in the desert. Because if you really believed in the desert, all you'd find is a single Higgs doublet with standard, the rest get eaten, with standard model properties, and that would, after a moment of excitement, there would be massive depression. You'd need drugs. Or you'd switch the field. Some of you would go into cosmology, some of you would go into condensed matter physics, some of you would go into string theory, and a few would go into finance. So most of us don't really believe in the desert. And if you don't believe in the desert, this is not an acceptable explanation. Of course, we don't know what the new physics is. Let's do an example to see what a little more explicitly what I mean by that. Right. But if you want to use this as the explanation without any other knowledge, then you have to believe in the desert. Because you need a new story associated with it. So let's do an example just to illustrate this. If you change the physics, do you think you could get such things? Got to get a little feeling for that. Well, luckily or unluckily, we've been talking about the hierarchy problem since like 1975 or whatever, since that paper, maybe even before that, I don't know. And we've built a lot of models to address the hierarchy problem. We've got a lot of extensions to weak scale, so let's just talk about this issue in the context of the most popular of them. The most popular of them is low-energy supersymmetry. I'm not giving, my opinion of what's the most likely, just that's certainly the most popular, or has been over time. So let's talk about this issue in low-energy supersymmetry. It's an example that has a lot of other stuff at the weak scale. Everybody with me so far? This is a pretty simple talk, I know, but I'm not getting paid enough to give you a fancy pants talk with a lot of equations, so I didn't even get any lunch. But I do like these boards, I have to say. Okay, so low energy supersymmetry, less. That's pretty funny, I know. So I'm going to assume we all know a little bit about supersymmetry. Not a hell of a lot. You write down a superpotential, it's got to be invariant under the gauge symmetry, then it's got scalars, fermions, and all the superfields. I'll put a hat on the field to denote a superfield. So I'm going to write out the superpotential, not the whole thing, but I'll write out some pieces that can violate baryon number. Well, in supersymmetry, these don't have to be fermions. In the superpotential, you think of them as scalars or superfields. They're scalars because the fermion parts have thetas with them. And so you can write this out in the superpotential. You don't need the lepton to make it Lorentz invariant. It's a renormalizable operator that violates baryon number. We're gone. We're history. We've decayed. You can also get things at dimension 5 before we get to dimension 6. So this is renormalizable. This is dimension 5. You can get. This is Landar, scale again for the new physics, where the new physics enters in. And if the couplings here, which I didn't even bother to write down in that example here, if they're order 1, then even lambda at the Planck scale, this would give too large a decay rate for proton decay. In usual models where Susie is broken at the weak scale, softly broken, let's say, et cetera, the usual class of models. And so this is an example where you put the new physics in, and this beautiful explanation we had goes away. Of course, there's other explanations around. People have used them. I'm not saying it's deadly. Usually they impose an R symmetry or something. The spirit of this talk is going to be that I'm not going to talk about global symmetries. I'm not going to impose global symmetries. Otherwise, I could impose a global symmetry that gave you baryon number conservation. I'm going to view gauge symmetries as more fundamental. Okay, so let's think about this a little bit more. I mentioned here that baryon number is anomalous. Similarly, lepton number is anomalous. There is a U1 quantum number you can define that's not anomalous. That's an act that you, which is baryon number minus lepton number, B minus L. So if I want to gauge something, I should try to gauge B minus L and use that to help explain the conservation of baryon number. And of course, that can get rid of this. But it doesn't get rid of this. This conserves B minus L. So you still need the desert, even if you gauge that. And it wouldn't get rid of these either. So this doesn't do the job. Of course, you could just gauge B. But I'm going to gauge B and L. Once you get in the business, you might as well be bold. So we'll be bold. So that's the story behind baryon number in the standard model and a little bit beyond. That provides the main motivation for what I'm doing. By a show of hands, most people did not believe in the desert, and therefore we're going to pursue this path for understanding the conservation of baryon number. If we end up having to do something horribly disgusting, then you just go home and say, I don't want to think about that anymore. If it's not so bad, then you might want to keep it in the back of your mind. So let me just say a few words about the lepton number story, much more briefly. How do we understand what we know about lepton number in the standard model? Well, again, so when we talk about the standard model, of course, we don't know that this is there. We don't know what this is there. So let me first talk about it without the right-handed neutrinos. So then in the standard model, without the right-handed neutrinos, we have to go to non-renormalizable operators before we can violate lepton number. It first happens at dimension 5 through operators like this, where my scale lambda is downstairs. And one of the most, and this gives you, after the Higgs gets a VEV, neutrino masses that are of order the vacuum expectation value that breaks the weak interaction, so I'll call it V sub W squared towards lambda. And here's kind of a neat thing. In order to explain the rough values of the neutrino masses, this lambda also ends up being about 10 to the 15th JeV. And this ratio of scales mechanism is usually called the seesaw mechanism. And that's quite an attractive thing. We know we know of that scale because of grand unification. And so within this desert picture, the neutrino masses fit in a very nice way. Most people believe that this is true. Although the neutrino mass, it could be that there's no right, it could be that that lepton number is conserved, and you have the right-handed neutrinos. Okay, so let me get a little better organized here. Let's say we add the right-handed neutrinos. How does the story go? Well, if we add the right-handed neutrinos, then you can still run this seesaw. This term here now violates lepton number. It's renormalizable, but its influence is quite small. The neutrino masses look like this when you integrate out the right-handed neutrinos, where these are matrices. So if the right-handed neutrinos are at this scale, you wouldn't see them. You get back to the seesaw mechanism. If you had lepton number conservation, it could be that this is zero. Then you'd have to get the neutrino masses from this term. And then you'd need really small Yukawas. That's the main reason why people think this sucks. You'd need Yukawas. I think it's something like 10 to the minus 14 for these dimensionless couplings. This is rather crude. They're really a matrix. Because the neutrino masses are very small. Did I write them down somewhere? Yeah, I wrote them down here. So usually people don't like that. So we don't think about that. Of course, it's useful to keep in the back of your mind the fact that we do observe very small Yukawas. For For example, the electron Yukawa, the electron's not very heavy, half an MeV, so the electron Yukawa is a number like 10 to the minus 5. So there are some very small Yukawas there, but nothing of this scale. Okay, so that's the story of baryon number and lepton number in the standard model. And now we're going to take the approach that we don't like the desert. We're going to see, just explore, if we can understand this conservation by having baryon number and lepton number be gauge symmetries. So there are several issues with that we have to overcome. A few hurdles. Obviously, if the hurdles were very high, I wouldn't be talking here because I'm not much of a hurdler. But I'll explain to you what they are, and then we'll jump over them. OK, so the first one. Well, I already told you that B and L are anomalous. So how can I gauge them? Well, you really can't, of course. But I'm using sloppy language. What I'm going to gauge are two new U1 symmetries, which I'll call baryon number and lepton number. And they will reduce the baryon number and lepton number on the ordinary quarks and leptons in the standard model, but I'll have to add new particles to cancel anomalies. And so they're really two new U1 symmetries that are extensions of baryon number and lepton number. Well, that's not such a big deal. That's mostly just language. Two, well, there doesn't seem to be a long-range force that couples to baryon number. So probably we have to spontaneously break the symmetry unless we want to have some ridiculously small coupling constant. So they have to be spontaneously broken. Now, spontaneously breaking them, well, then you don't have the symmetry anymore. So how can you use it to explain the conservation of baryon number? That really kind of sucks. The whole idea maybe kind of sucks. But it's actually not very hard, because let's think about the main restrictions on proton decay. You can look at nucleon decay, which can occur through processes that violate baryon number by 2 units, but those are the restrictions on the scale associated with that are very modest, because they're such high dimension operators. Let's think about proton decay. Nucleon decay. Well, the neutron decays, but it doesn't violate the baryon number. OK, so how can the proton decay? Well, we've got our favorite mode, P0 positron. And then we could have another mode, P0 positron nu bar, or P0 positron nu, et cetera. Lots of possible decays. The restrictions I'm putting on this for possible particles are energy conservation and angular momentum conservation. We're not interested in breaking Lorentz invariance here. That's another talk. You've got to invite somebody else for that talk. Actually, I think about 3 years ago I gave a talk on that. But it had to do with breaking it during inflation, not now. So what do we notice about these decays? Well, we're violating baryon numbers, so of course delta B is 1 by 1 unit. It's proton decay. And also, delta L in this is 1, 3, 5, et cetera. We can put as many odd. So all the possible things that give proton decay change baryon number, of course, by 1 unit, and lepton number by an odd number. So if we're going to gauge these symmetries, we're going to introduce fields that get vacuum expectation values that spontaneously break it. Let's call the fields SB and SL. For example, if the charge of this was 2, then you could never get proton decay. Because you can think of the Feynman diagram that gives proton decay as arising by inserting the S sub Bs and them getting you vacuum vacuum expectation values. And we're never going to get 1 by inserting any number of 2s. And similarly, another example is if the lepton number was even, let's say 2, the charge of SL was 2, we'd never get an odd number by inserting it. So you can end up with proton decay completely forbidden, even if you spontaneously break the symmetry, depending on the charges of the fields that break it, and they're not crazy charges, right? 2 and 1 are not crazy numbers. They're the first numbers you learn. They're even simpler than 0. 0 is really hard. So this is not such a big deal. Let's see, what else did I have to... one more thing. Well, you see, the limits on those, if you think of in terms of scale, they're really not very high scales because they're such high-dimension operators.
What's the scale?
Well, it's not much above the weak scale. You can also get nucleon decay. It gives a better limit, right, where two protons annihilate. Yeah. But you need 6 quarks, and so it becomes a very high-dimension operator.
Right.
And so the scale goes down a lot. But it's something to look at in the context of any particular model. Well, let's see. So we could do it, I guess, from just 6 quarks. Could be Lorentz invariant, have no color. So 6 times 3/2 is dimension 9, right? That would be the biggest operator possible as a local operator. Of course, in these models where you gauge B and L, you'd have to insert some of these S's as well, so it would go up in dimension. It depends on how big their VEV is compared to the scale. So you have to look at the particular model. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about that later. What else did I want to say? Okay, so there's also issues of cosmology. I'm not going to talk much about cosmology. I just heard a talk earlier in the week that said you can get whatever you want. I've summarized the talk. As long as it's before Big Bang nucleosynthesis. But, you know, we observe a baryon asymmetry. Maybe if you gauge it, it's harsh to generate a baryon asymmetry. But we don't observe this baryon asymmetry. This is just an aside remark. This baryon number has other fields, other particles that are charged under it. So it could be that in the universe, the dark matter also has a charge under this, so that the total asymmetry for this thing that's gauged is actually 0. But no more about cosmology. That's it. That's all. No more about cosmology. Okay, so we got to build a model. We got to build, what have I got now? Oh, I got lots of time. Okay, we got to build some models. So you have to decide how you're going to cancel anomalies. And basically, there's lots of ways to cancel anomalies. I forget the name of the person who wrote the first paper, but they gave the general conditions. And you can think of lots of models. So we need some guidance. We need some guidance for how we're going to cancel anomalies. And our guidance is going to be, under some set of rules, and I'll invent the rules, that we do the least speculative thing possible. Not necessarily the nicest thing. The nicest thing would be to add the least number of fields, but the least speculative. So you take the standard model, and we don't want to change it much. That's what I mean by less speculative. So what do we see in the standard model? We see generations of quarks and leptons. We see 3 of them. We have no understanding why. So probably the least speculative thing we can do is just add another generation, since we don't understand why there's 3. We already got generations. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to add another generation, a whole generation. And is it hard to cancel anomalies? Well, it's kind of pathetically easy to cancel anomalies. First of all, if I add a whole generation, I know the standard model anomalies will all cancel. That's what generations are designed to do. So all the SU2 squared plus U1, they're all going to cancel. All the anomalies, the problem we have, of course, the B cubed will cancel on this new generation because it's vector-like on a generation. All we have to do is worry about these ones linear. So let me add a new generation, generation 4. Oh, now I need more boards. Okay. Never have to erase here. This is just awesomely great. Hold on a second. Put this up. Of course, you can get confused, which I've got confused now. So now we're going to talk about canceling anomalies. Oh, now I have to get some references to some people. So this way of canceling anomalies and the model that I'm going to discuss a little bit about actually was first worked on by Caron and Murayama. And of course, obviously, I worked on it some, otherwise I wouldn't be mentioning it. My collaborator has two last names. So the big improvement in FISRAV-D between 1995 and 2010 was that the page numbers no longer make any sense. Don't ask me why they decided to do that. But you'll notice this paper is a very simple reference, but we kind of suck because there's an erratum. And then the page number no, doesn't make any sense. Okay. I'm not sure it was 2000. Maybe the erratum was 2001. Doesn't matter. Okay, so how are we going to cancel anomalies? Well, look it. It's very simple. All the anomalies were linear in B. Everything else just automatically canceled. You didn't have to think about it due to the generation structure. So add a lousy fourth generation and multiply B and L by minus 3 times what they are in the standard model, and you'll cancel anomalies. Don't have to think very hard. Is that clear? So that's what we're going to do. That's what I talked about last year. I'm going to go over that in a few minutes. Not in any detail because I did it last year. I'll just tell you some of the minuses. This is not going to be, don't worry, I'm not going to rewrite the whole table. What do you got? You got the fields. Let's call the fourth generation primed. Oh, I have to add right-handed neutrinos for this to work, for the anomaly cancellation to work properly. And then you have the standard model, SU3, SU2, U1, and this is just the same. And then you have U1B, U1L, and this is just minus 3. So this is minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 0. And okay, I can't do that. Do I need a hockey stick? Do I have another hockey stick here? No, this one's going up. Got confused. Well, we're going to wind it up in a moment anyways. Look at this. This is awesomely great. That works. We've canceled anomalies just by adding a fourth generation. That doesn't seem so speculative. That doesn't seem so bad. Hey, maybe we're onto something here. Maybe they're going to discover this, and then some of us will be famous. There's another way. I could change it to make this a mirror generation, everything right-handed, and just flip the signs there. Two ways. A fourth generation or what you might call a mirror fourth generation. Either one, depending on the charges you assume. Because in the anomaly equation, if you put an R, it flips a sign. Is that clear? Okay. That's the way we can cancel anomalies. And you can build a nice model built on this, which is what I talked about last time. It's got some nice properties. No flavor changing neutral currents at tree level. It's got a dark matter candidate. Yeah, you kind of put it in by hand, but it doesn't matter. And it's not too disgusting.
So what is a dark matter candidate?
You introduce a scalar that's charged under the baryon number. that doesn't get a vacuum expectation value, because you need some coupling between the fourth generation quarks and the ordinary ones so they can decay. Otherwise, they'd be stable. And that's the dark matter candidate. So I'm going to talk about it in the context of this other model where it's a similar thing is done, so there'll be a little more detail on that. Okay, so given this beautiful story, I hope you're convinced it's totally beautiful, why did I have to improve it? You don't improve on perfection. Well, obviously it's got a few warts. It's wearing a lot of makeup. So let's talk about the warts. The warts, like most warts for theorists, arise because of experiment. They're our worst enemy, the experimentalists. You know, imagine if there was no experiment. We could all build many beautiful theories in our own minds. They could each be nature, and life would be so beautiful for us. But alas, that's not the way it goes. There's only one correct thing, and we need experiment to find out what it is, unless we're incredibly smart or, you know, godlike in some way. But, you know, I'm not supposed to talk about God when I'm lecturing, otherwise I can get fired. There's only a few things you can get fired for. Obviously, I've lost track of how to use these boards now. Uh-oh. Okay. Let's talk about the fourth generation quarks. They're not ruled out, first of all. This theory might have a few warts, but it's still okay. They get mass through coupling to the Higgs. They can't mix with the ordinary quarks. They can't replace this with an ordinary doublet because they have different baryon numbers. So there's no mixing between the two, no flavor-changing neutral currents at tree level. That's really important. Otherwise, you gotta deal with all this flavor physics, which is something I actually know better than most other things. But anyway, so I don't want to deal with it now. So this is how they get mass. And the mass of the U prime and D prime go something like their Yukawas. What's not? The VEV that makes electroweak, and now I got to be careful. I got to put in the root 2, and with that convention, this is 250 JeV. And now experiment tells me that the masses of these things have to be greater than about 350 GeV. We haven't seen them. This comes from the Tevatron and from the LHC. You might think, wow, this is going to be like a TeV tomorrow from the LHC, but it takes a long time to improve this, these limits it ends up. So it's not going to go up very fast, so I'm told, anyways. So what does that tell me? That tells me that G U prime D prime is greater than 2. And these couplings, the Yukawas, are not asymptotically free. They grow as you increase the scale. And it ends up that as you go above the weak scale, only a couple of orders of magnitude, that's fast enough to go into the strong coupling regime, or in perturbation theory, to develop a Landau pole. So these are effective theories below some scale, and the scale's not very far above the weak scale. I like to go, you know, far above the weak scale if I'm going to invent a whole new theory, not be stuck to a few orders of magnitude below the weak scale. Some people love this. They love the fact it's strongly coupled. Talk to Bob Holdem. He loves it. I don't understand the theories when they get strongly coupled, so I'm going to view this as a wart, not as a plus. I want to have a theory like supersymmetry. What's so great about supersymmetry is you can understand it up to very high scales. It's a sensible thing you can calculate. I want a theory like that. I want something I can take home to my mom. Not a theory with a Landau pole, like a few orders of magnitude above the weak scale. There's another related thing. Not so related, which is the fact that these heavy quarks, if you go ahead and calculate the Coleman-Weinberg potential with the coupling this strong, they destabilize the Higgs potential, unless the Higgs is very heavy. You could fix that again by adding new stuff at the weak scale, scalars that couple to the Higgs, but again, it would be just an effective theory. I'd have to add more stuff. Don't like it. These are the main problems. Another one is precision electroweak. You can make this fit precision electroweak, but I don't know if you remember this. There's sort of a triangle of what's allowed in S and T, an ellipse, not a triangle. So it looks like that, right? It's no units. I have no notes. I haven't looked back in this for like 6 months. Where do you have to live here? Well, it ends up these quarks give a large contribution to S, independent of the mass once they get heavy. So you go up here. And if their mass difference is about 50 JeV, you can move over to the tip of the ellipse. So you got to live here for precision electroweak. And the fit's not quite as good as the standard model, even living there. Well, it's not a huge problem, but that's where you got to live, at the tip of the ellipse. So those... Pardon?
What's ST?
Oh, these are precision electroweak variables. They have to do with corrections like this. They characterize correction to the weak gauge boson propagators. So if you call this pi, they involve derivatives of pi with respect to q squared. So T, for example, you have to break what's called a weak custodial isospin to get a contribution to T. So you need a mass difference between the U prime and the D prime. If they were degenerate, you'd still get a contribution to this S, which would move you up here. And then you put in some T and you move over there. Yeah. I don't remember the precise definitions. I'm sorry. Okay. So those are the issues. Those are the things that we want to fix. And now I'll use the last 10 minutes or so to discuss a model that doesn't have these bad issues. Everybody, is this clear? Well, I'm going to have to change the field content a bit. You'll see in a moment. And I said I wanted to do the least speculative thing possible, so that was which was this or mirror. So something's got to give, right? Something's got to give here. Well, I'm going to change this or mirror to this and mirror. In other words, I'm going to add a vector-like fourth generation. This was actually suggested, not this specifically, was suggested by Nimar Khani Hamed when my collaborator was chatting with him. So why does this do the job? So now let me just make it clear. As far as particle content goes, we're now adding still a fourth generation, but a vector-like fourth generation. Now, I could have called this five generations, but, you know, this is like when you go to the car dealer. You know, if the car's got, like, one cylinder, it's good on gas. If it's got, you know, eight cylinders, it's powerful. So we'll call it a vector-like fourth generation. So now I'm going to give you the specific model that I have in mind, and you'll see how the anomalies cancel. And why is it so easy to do all this? It's so easy because the anomalies all come from the part linear in B, and when I add a whole generation, all the other parts automatically cancel. So we can clearly do it as long as the difference in charges between this and the mirror are the minus 1 and the minus 3. It's going to work, right? It's linear in B, the anomalies we have to cancel. And everything else just automatically works from the generation structure. So that's what we're going to do. So now let me just, so I'm going to call these, I have to give them names now. So these got a prime. I'm going to call the mirror double prime. Oh, dang. Double prime to denote the mirror fields. Everybody with me? I don't want to rewrite the whole table again, changing all the L's to R's and R's to L's. And okay. I'm lost. Is there an eraser?
There's a very right,
yeah. Oh, okay. There's a lot of boards here. Yeah, maybe you should try not to erase anything. I don't want to break the boards. One time when I was lecturing at Caltech, our building's really old, the board went up like that, and the whole row across the top came crashing down. Very good. Now I'm, of course, afraid of blackboards because of that. Okay, so we're going to assign baryon number of the Q primes minus baryon number of the Q double primes equal to minus 1, and the lepton number of the, just schematically, to be minus 3. Then the anomalies are done. So how does this help? We've got to write down a Lagrangian and see how it helps. Okay. So first of all, the quarks. I'm going to concentrate mostly on the quarks. So let's say, how do the quarks get mass? So this is prime or double prime mass. Oh, well, they got a couple to the Higgs again. So there's HU, a lot of Yukawa couplings, QL prime, H dagger U right prime. I guess this has got to be, dang. That's a dumb. I won't write down the downs. They're similar. But now, here's the key. I can have this. Which is a mass term. This is, of course, invariant under everything except for baryon number, because it's a vector-like generation with respect to everything except baryon number. So if the field that breaks baryon number, S sub b, the scalar, has charge minus 1, I can write down these terms here. And these can give mass to everything, such terms. There's a lambda. This I should have called. Oh, I'm not going to use my hand. I'm going to be smart. I'm capable of being smart one of every five times.
Didn't you have to have the same head charge too?
No, the difference in the charges on the left and right is one. And it's the difference of those charges that comes in here.
I didn't quite refer to scattering, that's proton decay. Yeah. I thought the scattering didn't have charge.
We haven't done the leptons yet. Yeah. We haven't done the leptons. So this is not going to be enough to forbid proton decay completely. It ends up that this would be enough if I said nothing about the leptons to get the scale down to 10 to the 10th jev from 10 to the 15. We could talk about that later, because I'm running. And similarly, there's a lambda u and a lambda d that they all pair up. So they get, when this gets a vev that breaks baryon number, everything gets a mass. These also contribute to the mass when the Higgs gets a vev, but those Yukawas do not have to be large. And so with those Yukawas not large, then there's no problems with precision electroweak, with Landau poles, with precision, with any of these issues that I brought up before. There is a minus. Nothing determines the scale, right? It doesn't have to be at the weak scale where we do it, which is all we're going to probe experimentally or an order of magnitude above that. But we have succeeded in gauging the baryon number. Well, they don't have to be zero, but as long as the couplings are not large, then these effects go away.
But the precision electroweak comes to the gauge quantum numbers, right?
Yeah, but if they're vector-like, they're decoupling.
Yeah, so you're just raising the mass scale.
You don't even have to raise it very much. That means that they tend to cancel left and right. And you can still have them at, you know, even... It suppresses it somewhat. Yeah. Well, T is not a problem, but it suppresses S somewhat. So they don't have to be super heavy, but I'm going to imagine they're somewhat heavier than the weak scale anyways, because there's no reason for this to be tied to the weak scale. We know they're not lighter.
So the lore is that S just counts the number of degrees of freedom. That's not correct.
Well, you have to put, these are not all, they're not the same. They're left-handed and right-handed. So once they get above a TeV, it's a very small contribution to S. You don't have to push it very far. Basically, it's because they're decoupling. A TeV is enough. Okay, so we've got to talk about the leptons. But before I do that, let's say you just wanted to gauge B and not L. You could do it, actually, if you took the original particle content and left out the lepton prime and lepton double prime. You know anomalies would cancel because you can write a bare mass term for those if you don't have lepton number gauged. And so just these new quarks are enough to let you gauge baryon number without gauging the lepton number. It's another way to cancel anomalies if you're just gauging B. Not a full generation, but only on the quark part, provided you have it being vector-like with respect to the standard model quantum numbers, you cancel the standard model anomalies. But that's an aside. We're actually going to gauge L. And so let me talk a little bit about that. So what do I want to do when I gauge L? I like the seesaw. I want the seesaw. I want a seesaw. Should I say that one more time?
We got it.
If I want a seesaw, then the if I want to add just one scalar, it's got to have lepton number 2. Nu R, S sub L. When that gets a VeV, it makes the right hand neutrino masses, and you got a seesaw. So that's what we're going to do, because I like to play with the seesaw. Any more here? I'm just going to stay in this room and play with the boards for the rest of the month. Okay. So let's look at that. What can we do? Well, we can add new things. I'm almost done, don't worry. I have to talk about so this is like the L prime, L double prime masses, and this is where they come from. Then I have to talk about the ordinary leptons. Well, that's just the standard model way. And I've left out all the indices for flavor on the standard model fields. And then when this gets a VeV, you get the seesaw mechanism. It doesn't have to be the gut scale. It doesn't have to be the weak scale. It could be some intermediate scale. But you'll notice that because in order to have a seesaw, this has quantum numbers 2, I can't write down the bare mass terms for these vector-like things. So there is something left over in this model at the weak scale. The leptons only get mass through the Higgs doublet, and so I have 2 charged leptons left over with a weak scale mass and 2 neutral leptons. Uh-oh! Maybe I'm back in the soup here. I have to talk about now what the limits are in lepton masses. Maybe I'll have all the same problems, but it ends up leptons are hard to see in hadron colliders. And so the masses are much, restraints are much weaker. The mass of the charged lepton charged leptons has to be greater than about 100 GeV, and the mass of the neutral leptons greater than about, I don't remember the number, let's say 70 GeV. And so these constraints just aren't as strong. The Yukawas don't have to be as large, and you don't need to have a cutoff very near the weak scale. The strongest constraint actually comes from destabilizing the Higgs potential, not from the Landau pole, because we all kind of believe the Higgs mass will be less than around 140 GeV, and so that's kind of a lightish mass.
And that's what was different about this from the quark. So why is something lighter and one lighter?
It's because to write something vector-like, I had to be able to write down an operator like this, and that means the charge here has to be 3. But in order to get the seesaw, I had charge 2. So if I want to do it with just one field, then the charge is such that I can't write down the vector-like mass terms. And it's kind of nice because it leaves something left over at the weak scale, a remnant, that you could try to find experimentally. I'm running out of time, so I have to say that you have to add a scalar, like I said before, that lets you couple the prime fields to the ordinary quarks so that they can decay. It has baryon number, and I just assume it doesn't get a vacuum expectation value. And it ends up being, if it's light enough, the lightest new particle with this baryon number, stable, and is a dark matter candidate. Let me say one more thing about finding these leptons at the weak scale. They're hard to find at a hadron collider. It might take years. But this model will probably be ruled out or confirmed by the end of the year, if we're a little lucky. Why do I say that? So let me explain to you. That's the punchline, right? The big punchline is that we're going to know. I had to give the talk this year because next year I'll either be too famous to come talk to you or my model will be ruled out. Probably the latter. That's just a joke. So it's because the Higgs is an amazing particle. It's really sensitive to a lot of things. Why do I say that? Especially if it's lightish. Well, if the Higgs is lightish, then all of its properties are suppressed in the standard models. Decays occur at one loop. Its production occurs at one loop. They're all tiny, and so they're sensitive to other stuff. What's sensitive to these charged leptons? Well, if the Higgs is light enough, lighter than about 140, you have a chance of seeing it in the gamma-gamma mode. If it gets heavier than that, then the branching ratio to WW becomes so large, it's really hard to see the gamma-gamma. It's already suppressed, like 2 times 10 to the minus 3 branching ratio. So where does that come from? In the standard model, there's 2 Feynman diagrams. There's one with a top in the loop, and there's one with W. And they kind of interfere destructively. Kind of. They interfere destructively. But now we have new leptons with masses around the weak scale that arise from coupling to the Higgs. And so there's one more Feynman diagram. There's the one with the E prime and the E double prime, and they're charged. They couple to photons. So you've got to add this in. And when you add this in, it ends up that the branching ratio for Higgs to go to gamma-gamma, almost independent of the Higgs mass and the lepton mass, once it satisfies this bound, is about equal to 1/3 of the branching ratio in the standard model. So that's the first easiest signature in a hadron collider environment of this particular model, which I call the nicest of the models. So I haven't, done the calculation to show you the number. It is roughly 1/3 independent of the masses.
Sorry, the fact it went down means that this is the destructive. I thought you were going to say that the destructive interference is now being ruined by this, and so you're getting a bigger effect.
No, it enhances the destructive interference, so it reduces it somewhat. Now, if you had a whole generation, including the quarks, it reduces it by an order of magnitude. But that's actually invisible at the LHC, because the quarks also couple to the gluons, and it enhances the production by just about an order of magnitude. So the production times branching ratio ends up the same. What a weird world we live in. Well, maybe we don't live in that world, but that would be bizarre. But if you're only adding the leptons, you don't affect the production, and this goes down by 1/3. So it would be great if you could see it both in WW and this channel. Then you could see the Higgs. If it was light enough so you only had a chance in gamma-gamma, this would be kind of depressing, right? 3 matters a lot. 3 changes 3 years to 10 years, for example. That's bad. That's really bad. So that's the story. I'm sorry I didn't have a little more time to flush out a few more things. I mean, it's not incredibly ugly. It has some of the nice things with the standard model, no flavor chain and neutral currents at tree level. Of course, it has these extra fields. What can I do? The vacuum expectations values are not tied to the weak scale. I don't know when it will happen, what scale you'd see these effects, but if you use this simplest type of structure with the charges outlined, it does leave these leptons over light, which you could see, and they do have this effect on the Higgs. Thank you. Perfection for this.
So then you can see W's and
right. Yeah. Well, maybe they shouldn't have seen the bump in the photons because of this, but it's not very significant what's there so far. But we'll see. Probably by the end of the, probably at the standard model, right? Not this, not low energy SUSY, and then they'll see this in a couple of years, or with it, depending on how well it works, or a year, and it'll be a 1, and then we'll know that this is not how. If it's less, of course, there's other things that could make it less, too. There'd certainly be an enhanced interest in looking for the charged leptons.
Is the variable number of digit field mixed with the Z?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So the new U1s, lepton number and baryon number, they can mix with the Z. And I haven't looked at that too much, but it doesn't take, so it's just basically some coupling like this, epsilon F mu nu Y F mu nu baryon number or lepton number. And I haven't really explored the phenomenology of these epsilons, but I'm pretty sure as long as the epsilons are less than like 10 to the minus 2, then there won't be any problem with experiment in this mixer, 10 to the minus 3, because they're heavy gauge bosons. The heavier they are, the less of a problem. And we got lots of couplings of that size. This is a dimensionless coupling. It's not, wouldn't have a fine-tuning problem the way the cosmological constant or the Higgs mass does. Any other questions or comments?
What's your take on Harry?
I don't know. I've kind of lost my religion. Maybe I even have to mention the A word or something. You know what the A word is? Anthropic. I don't know. It seems like it should be a problem, right? You add 10 to the 30, some number here, well, 10 to the 30 plus an input parameter equals 100. It sounds kooky, right? But I don't know. I kind of lost my religion.
Just for waiting? I mean, you lost it for a reason or just
Well, I guess, you know, when I look at Susie, for example, and I step back for a moment, and it's things like this baryon number that it's not as nice as the standard model in that way. I have to add some more words. You can add the words, but it doesn't fit. It's got a mu problem. It just doesn't. Somehow, maybe I'm wrong, but when you hit it right, it should just all fit together. So that's what I believe in my gut. And it just doesn't quite all fit together. It still could be right. Could be we haven't seen precisely how it fits because we try to be minimal and you need a few more pieces. Or it could be that it doesn't have to fit like a glove. And then the other things, large extra dimensions, I don't know. I don't believe they really, maybe two extra dimensions are okay. No, I have a reason for that, actually. The reason is I can understand how to stabilize those. With the higher ones, it's hard for me to see how to stabilize them. So it's like you haven't really solved the hierarchy problem. But still, extra dimensions seem a lot more speculative than more particles. I don't know. Maybe I'm too conservative. So I think that's a real long shot. And could be strong coupling, something like Technicolor, but we haven't seen how it works yet. But there's no hints, right? You look at the LHC, we're almost up to a TEV and limits on squarks. There's no hints of anything. It's starting to make me nervous. You know, I go home at night, my hand shakes. You know, I look at the LHC paper as the limits go up, the shakes get worse. What do people think here? Are you a little nervous now? No? You're a believer? Well, then here's another thing that bothers me about the hierarchy problem, although I know you have a point of view on this as well, and that if I'm just totally naive and I look at the cosmological constant, it looks like the same type of fine-tuning problem. And if we had lived in a world where accelerators could only get up to a fraction of an EV, of course, we still had the proton and neutron, but I mean an excitation energy and the electron. Then we'd say we're just about to discover supersymmetry. We're going to find the partner of the electron a little bit heavier to solve the cosmological constant problem, and we would have been disappointed. So
you can say that till Halloween. Right?
Till Halloween when you come to Caltech. Yeah. I'm kind of nervous, but we'll see. It's a great thing about physics. You know, you don't have to argue about these things. We'll just see. Data will tell us.
All right. Let's thank you again.
Looks like a